We cut our teeth on Latin American politics with some of Professor Smith's works. He's the author of too many books to list here, including Talons of the Eagle, Dynamics of U.S. Latin American Relations, Democracy in Latin America, Political Change and Comparative Perspective is his most recent work, and provides what I think is an outstanding analysis of the democratization process that is taking place in the region over the past 15, 20 years. Today, Professor Smith will be talking, as you can see, on Latin America's pink tide and how the U.S. is reacting to this slight, some would say, shift to the left that's taking place in Latin America. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that. Great presentation, great introduction, and I am very happy to be here. And I realize that there's a beautiful Friday afternoon, and there's this basketball game later on. And who wants to sit in a room without windows when you have other opportunities? Well, we've become a self-selected group in that sense. I also have to express a certain degree of thanks to President Bush, because as I was thinking about this topic, I sent in a title, and then I began to try to think about the relationship between the pink tide and the United States, and I kind of had some ideas of my own, but it really wasn't self-evident or extremely clear to me until he had the courtesy to make a tour of Latin America, in which case a lot of issues became more clear to me, and which I will try to discuss with you today. So I owe some degree of thanks to our president. The others, I very rarely quote Henry Kissinger, as you will discover from the quips in the course of this talk. But as John was talking about, you know, the things I've had the temerity to write, he almost said, you know, he's written more things than we should all have to read. Henry Kissinger once, I heard him say that in his self-effacing way in that baritone of his, that someone introduced him as this author of all these books, and he said, you know, someone once wrote a review of one of my books, and he paused and said, I don't remember which one it was. Right, Henry. And this reviewer said in the course of his review that the book was very dense and it was very full of analysis and it was very challenging. And he couldn't tell if Henry Kissinger was a great writer, but he could tell that if anyone who finished this book was a great reader. And in that sense, I salute those of you who have had to work your way through some of the stuff I've had the pleasure or bad taste to write. So look, the topic today is this pink tide in Latin America. Whatever it is, how it affects U.S. interests, and whether, in fact, it does affect U.S. interests, and who might perceive it that way. So the questions that we want to ask have to do with what is this pink tide? Why has it come about? Who belongs to it? What does it represent? What do we see? What are its goals? What are its capabilities? How does and might it affect U.S. interests? Not necessarily. I mean, it's not self-evident that it affects U.S. interests in very clear ways. U.S. interest as defined how? What do we mean by U.S. interest? And who gets to define U.S. interest? And what does all of this portend for the future of Latin America and of U.S.-Latin American relations? Now, if I can answer all those questions in 45 minutes, you know, we'll be in great shape, but I'll at least try to outline some ways to approach these questions. Okay, the pink tide. What are we talking about? We're talking about a political movement, a series of movements in different countries of Latin America that has its origins in basically popular discontent and popular disenchantment. Disenchantment on the economic front with a lack of growth, at least through the year 2003. Disenchantment with the persistence of poverty and inequality, even with the arrival of growth after 2003. Frustration with neoliberal economics and the Washington Consensus. People are frustrated with that. People are frustrated with the weakness of representative institutions, for example, the legislatures and the political parties in much of Latin America. They're frustrated with the inattention to the poor, on the part of elected leaders. They're frustrated with the persistence of corruption. They're frustrated on the international front, in many cases, with the war in Iraq. And I think it would be interesting to make a singular study of the effect of the war in Iraq on political attitudes in Latin America. I'll give that to your LACOPS group that can study this. Opposition to Bush policies, not only in Latin America, but also and especially in Iraq. And by that I mean not only the policies, but Abu Ghraib and all of the other things that we've heard about, and Guantanamo specifically. And a growing, as I mentioned at lunch, a sort of distaste for American society. It used to be the case that my Latin American friends would disagree with U.S. policies, but they'd say we love the people. You know, we wear Gap jeans, we go to Hollywood films, we listen to American music, write music right here from Grand Ole Opry, etc. We love that, we just dislike the policies. What is beginning to change is a sense of a rejection of American society as a whole. You guys elected him not only once, but twice. You guys have put up with some of these abuses, and they're sort of in Brazil and in other countries, a kind of McDonald's, there are attacks on McDonald's and boycotts of American goods. It's a very different feel about it. It's not like we can all go to Latin America and say, well, you know, there's the government over there and then there's me down here. It's quite a different sea change, I think, in perception of the United States. And all of these sorts of disenchantments and feelings feed into the groundswell of what has become the pink tide. Now, the way people normally talk about the pink tide has to do with the election of so-called populist or so-called leftist presidents. The first one being Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 1998. There was a referendum in August of 2004, and he was reelected in 2006. One of the signatures of these leaders is that they acquire power through free and fair democratic elections. We're not talking about revolutionary movements. We're not talking about military coups. We're talking about access to power through free and fair elections. A second major election yielding what someone often regarded as a core member of the group is Lula of Brazil, elected in 2002. In 2006, followed by Néstor Kirchner in Argentina, whose move to the so-called left surprised a number of leaders. After all, he was a Peronist political leader. But nonetheless, he joined this camp. Evo Morales in Bolivia in 2005, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua in 2006, and Rafael Correa in Ecuador also in 2006. In addition, there were at least two near misses, Ollanta Humala in Peru in 2006, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, also 2006, who lost by a hair's breadth, and who, as I mentioned to people at lunch today, really should have won the election if he'd run a decent campaign. I'm not commenting on the vote count. I'm saying that the vote should have come out differently if he'd run a decent campaign. So in any event, this is a groundswell. And it's a groundswell that has, to me, a variety of certain characteristics. People come to power through election. What this shows is that the electoral process in Latin America makes it possible for the left to win. My own analysis of elections in the 1980s and 1990s shows that the left really could not win or did not win for a variety of reasons. In some countries, the left, as one might think of it, had been decimated during years of repression in some countries. One thinks of Argentina, for example. Chile is another where the left was contained and really punished. But also, with the so-called third wave or third cycle of democratization in Latin America, there came a number of institutional reforms that, in my view, were designed to prevent the victory of the left. Take majority runoff elections, for example. What it often meant in Brazil is that Lula of the left would get to run in the second round, but then the opponent would be able to cobble together a coalition that would defeat him. And one of the ways that Lula got around that was to move more and more toward the center in successive elections to the point where some of his former supporters said that, you know, Lula was not Lula anymore, that you really had to gravitate away from the left in order to win under MRO elections. A number of kind of institutional devices like that. I personally think that one of the great specters that hung over these new democracies or restored democracies in Latin America was the specter of Salvador Allende, who actually won an election in 1970 with a smaller share of the votes than he got in 1964. But because it was a three-way race instead of a two-way race, without MRO, without a second round, he was able to win. So part of it was, we're not going to let that happen. And indeed, a number of institutional reforms were designed to drive politics toward the center, it seems to me. But it turns out that, in fact, the left can win. The left, again, we'll get into definitions in a second. One way you can win is by getting a majority vote in the first round. Evo Morales did that in Bolivia. Another way you can do it is by gravitating, you know, still holding on to your voters on the left and gravitating toward the center, as Lula did. Another way you can do it is by having a not very effective opposition candidate in the second round, as in my view, Rafael Correa did in Ecuador. But in any event, it has become possible, as we can see from these examples, for the left to win. And indeed, in Mexico, which only has a single round, that should have made it easier for López Obrador to win. And as I said before, had he run and had his advisors run a decent campaign, it's little doubt in my mind that he would have won. He had a 10 or 12% lead in the polls, which he managed to squander in the course of a very bad campaign. In any event, one thing about Latin American elections these days is that it is possible for the left to win. What this does is to lead to considerable ideological diversity within the continent. One study, I mean, it all depends on definition, right? But one recent report suggests that nowadays, of 18 countries that this report reviewed in Latin America, 7 have governments of the right, 3 have governments of the center, which would include Chile, for example, and 8 have governments of the left, depending again on what you mean. But what it means is that the effective ideological spectrum at the level of presidential power is very broad in Latin America now. Okay, so we have to think of a region that covers the entire political spectrum rather than one that follows lockstep in one way or the other. A second thing, or second observation to make, as I suggested earlier, is that this is not a kind of organized movement. It's not like these guys, you know, meet in some secret cell and organize their campaigns. They respond, each of these campaigns and victories, to domestic issues. And to domestic concerns, that is, Correa won because of issues in Ecuador. Chavez won because of issues in Venezuela. Lula has won because of issues in Brazil. These are homegrown political movements. They're not part of orchestrated international things, so that when we speak of the pink tide, we should be careful not to assume that it has these kind of organizational elements from the start. Indeed, there's noticeable quite a Chavista backlash. Whenever Hugo Chavez has tried to endorse political candidates that he would like to see win, he has managed to help defeat them. This happened in Peru, for example. It happened very explicitly in Mexico with the case of López Obrador. Lombardo Toledano was a leftist of the 30s and 40s. Sorry. You know, they're all the same to me. But the opposition, you know, the Calderon campaign that won, you know, mounted a series of campaigns saying, you know, you vote for López Obrador and you get Hugo Chavez. And this kind of fear campaign was really promoted very strongly within the Mexican electorate and was one of the reasons that López Obrador lost by this very, very narrow margin. So being over-affiliated with Hugo Chavez has not helped people at the campaign stage at all. anything, it perhaps cost the election of someone who would have been his counterpart in Peru as well as in Mexico. So that it's not like there's this kind of lockstep or disciplined organization that is seeking, you know, to take over Latin America. It's a much more, it's a confluence, a spontaneous confluence of events from different national levels, with the possibility of a Chavista backlash. There's also, it's not like, you know, you get a club card and you belong to the Pink Tie and are certified as a member of the Pink Tie. People, you know, some of the membership isn't really all that clear. You know, even some people would say Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, although, you know, he was the leader of the Sandinistas, that he's drifted so far to the center and has made enough to, you know, kind of Castian bargains with the conservative opposition that, you know, his background would qualify him for the Pink Tie, but his actual behavior and current pronouncements make him a little bit suspect in that regard. Similarly, the president of Uruguay, Tabaré Vázquez, has signed an economic framework agreement with the United States, which does a number of things. One thing it does is to send shivers throughout Mercosur, because if Uruguay, a member of Mercosur, signs a free trade agreement later on with the United States, that sort of unravels Mercosur, so it's a significant kind of development, a little hard to read, and there's still a lot of political debate about that. And even Lula himself, who aspires to be, you know, the principal spokesperson for Latin America at the international level, he would have to regard himself as a great rival of China. So in some ways, he's following a somewhat different course, in which he would moderate relations between Latin America and the United States and serve as sort of the cultural broker between them. In fact, you know, my own reading of traditional Brazilian foreign policy, to put it in a nutshell, is that Brazil has seen itself as the natural leader of South America and had a brief rival in Argentina for that mantle early in the 20th century, but no longer. So Brazil is the leader of South America, that the United States would be the leader of North America, and that in a sort of joint tendency, these two countries would co-govern the Western Hemisphere. Brazil as a leader kind of the stature of and in partnership with the United States. And I really see Lula as very much in that tradition. There is a part of that policy which makes you anti-US when you're trying to build up your power and consolidate enough strength to declare yourself as the unchallenged leader of South America. That means you're kind of also, you know, pushing aside U.S. influence within South America, not to mention Chavista influence also. But as you assert the power over your own domain, in some sense you're challenging the United States. Once you've done that, you become the partner of the United States. So that in some ways, you know, this leads to an ambiguous set of behaviors that don't follow easy categorization, and we'll see that a little bit later. So I see Lula, although he has, you know, leftist political principles in a variety of ways and clearly represents and speaks for the Brazilian masses and aspires to bring about socioeconomic change and socioeconomic reform, he also is a Brazilian nationalist in this sense, in my view. So that he really corresponds to a traditional reading of Brazilian foreign policy, which has this ambivalent kind of relationship. So he's a kind of moves alongside of Chavez at the same time that he has been at least a personal friend of Chavez, and he's also a rival of Chavez because he wants Brazil to be the undisputed leader of South America rather than Venezuela. So there are these ambiguities about membership, right? And it's not like everybody takes an oath of allegiance to Hugo Chavez at all. I think when we think of, when we observe this Pink Tide, there is this tendency to count up the number of presidents who are kind of leftist in some way or other, and score them as belonging to the pink tide or not, and that really determines our sense of the size and strength of the pink tide. I think that's misleading, because some candidates who are very much ideologically in tune with the pink tide have lost, but they lost by close margins. And I think the real thing to think about is not how many presidents, you know, won or did not, because that depends a lot on electoral rules, on the vagaries and whims of the electorate at the time of the election, et cetera, et cetera, but to look at Latin American society. And my own sense of it is that as I think about this pink tide and think about Latin American society in general terms, now those of you who work on Latin American political attitudes can correct me, so I say this with a certain amount of temerity in this audience. But, you know, my sense is that a third to a half of the people in most countries are really fed up, really dissatisfied, and they would vote or have voted or at least have the kind of attitudes that would have led them to vote for a pink tide candidate if there were one. And maybe, you know, maybe a quarter to max 40% are sort of satisfied with the current conditions and would vote for other candidates. But that the real story here, I think, is not at the presidential level or only at the presidential level. The real story is at the societal level and the extent of frustration and disenchantment and disappointment that exists among up to half of the Latin American society, would be my reading. Now, you might disagree with the up to a half. You might say it's only 40%. I will accept that. But a very significant share and variation among countries. But a very significant share of the population of Latin America, after all of these neoliberal reforms, after the resurrection of democracy in countries that had them before, after all of this experience with these experimentations, is still extremely frustrated. That's the story. So what we're looking at is the reflections and the outcomes of that story, rather than, in some ways, the guts of the story itself. Now look, it matters what you call things. Language is important in politics. And it's very easy to pick up, you know, a newspaper and see that they call so-and-so a certain name. And as political analysts and political scientists and students of human behavior, we should be very careful with the language that we use. We should not simply accept a label that is given someplace. We should think about it very carefully. So when you say so-and-so is a populist, and the press calls so-and-so a populist, even if The Economist calls somebody a populist, you know, you might not agree with their labeling. What does populist suggest? A populist suggests that a populist is irresponsible. A populist is kind of utopian. A populist is demagogic, makes promises that can't possibly be fulfilled, unlike other politicians. A populist is somehow a naive political actor who appeals, in addition to the sort of personal proclivities, appeals to what the French used to call the dangerous classes. The masses down there who are also uninformed, uneducated, they're not very much like us. So that there's a sense that these guys are dangerous and they're naive and they're irresponsible. They will either through malice or ignorance commit heinous sins and bring negative policies upon their people and the rest of the world. That's what the implication is when you use that term. If you call them pink, which is what we're doing now, well, what are you saying? You're saying, well, it's less radical than red. Kind of the same color, but different shade. Right? It's like that, but less than. Well, you sort of dilute political attitudes or political ideologies or goals, and you start from red over here on the real left, and then you dilute it, and you get these guys. There's a sense that pink political leaders are likely to be independent of international movements that in the old days of reds, I mean, when there was really, you know, communist movement and people belonged to the Communist Party, they were red, and what part of what made them red was participation in organized international movement. And this does suggest somehow that these pink leaders are independent of international movements, and that somehow this they emerged in the post-Cold War environment, since there were no reds left, except in other parts of the world, that, you know, what you get is this kind of diluted, soft, you know, not very clearly defined shade of pink. So it carries a different set of connotations. Again, not as derogatory as populist, but it suggests has a different set of suggestions. If you were to call someone on the left, you know, you're really saying, well, that's, you know, pink is more moderate. A pink, you know, would a European social democrat be called pink? No, although the ideology is very close. But if someone is on the left, the presumption, the implication of the language is that you're doctrinaire, right, that you're anti-American, that your views are derivative of Marx if they don't come from Marx. You don't have to read Marx to be a Marxist. In fact, very few Marxists actually went to the trouble of reading Marx. And that somehow, because there's this pole of left and right, that the left is over here and the right is over here, so you're at the opposite end of the pole from these guys on the right, whatever that means. So that political language, you know, as an animal, you know, tends to be vague. It tends to carry a series of connotations and sometimes lead to imprecise argumentation. Let me make an old-fashioned argument. The old-fashioned argument is, I suppose you could put me in a pink tie if you want, that in a sense, you know, at the end of the Cold War, the left was gone. You know, there was no more left. Well, that seems to me to be pushing it. You know, to say that the Soviet Union collapsed does not mean that it's not possible to have a set of ideas that might correspond to something that we might call the left, and that if we think of a political spectrum as the definition of left or right, having to do with attitudes or ideologies along a political spectrum, then we can still think of a left and a right. You might say, well, there are only people on the right over here, and that the left end of that spectrum, you know, ranges from center right to right. But in fact, I think what we're seeing in Latin America is a broadening of that spectrum and a resurrection of at least some of the notions of the left. So let me just run through this real quickly, because I think it is possible to think we can use the language of a pink tie. Underneath it, I think, is a perception that there are some positions or ideas that are held by not only by the leaders, but by followers of this pink tie. The keystone here is that the left, its lemma, its motif, its general purpose is what we might call social justice. On the right is individual freedom. I mean, these are all noble principles, right? Correct? But that these are different. And that for people on the left, societal well-being, that is the well-being, greatest good of the greatest number, I'm not sure Jeremy would like that, is really the way to judge, you know, political performance and political practice. Whereas on the right, personal autonomy is the key. You know, the right to bear arms, the right to whatever it is you want to do. That these are two different sort of sets of attitudes along his spectrum. That on the left, there's aspiration of equal opportunity for everybody. On the right, the notion would be survival of the fittest. You know, the reason we're on top is that we're the fittest. And this is a notion that has come down to American history over the years. That's not really the point. But that these are different ways of looking at the world and different attitudes. That someone on the left would say, we need a strong state to correct social inequities in the system. Someone on the right, in this view, would say, well, leave it to the market and the invisible hand of the market. That's the more efficient mechanism. Someone on the left would say, we need the state, a strong state, in order to help redistribute material goods in a less unfair way. The right would say, look, let the market do its business and the distribution of goods will trickle down appropriately to people who have less. Don't interfere with the process. Someone on the left would say, look, we need to bring about basic structural change. Someone on the right would say, it's the status quo. The way it is is because it's supposed to be the way it is. So essentially, you know, there are different kinds of attitudes. We can speak of being on the left and on the right. And that indeed in Latin America, there is now emerging, you know, call it a neo-Marxist or whatever you want to call it, kind of ideological left that is homegrown. An izquierda criolla, right, that grows up from local conditions. These guys are not all, you know, reading Hegelian tracts and looking at sort of dialectics that yield various kinds of solutions. They're looking at social realities and arriving at these attitudes because it is their sense of the way the world works and what the world needs. So you don't have to be a Marxist to be on the left, right? You don't have to have, you know, conducted an exegesis of these complicated texts to be on the left. Lula can be on the left. Chavez can be on the left, although he claims to have read stuff. We'll see that in a moment. But that's not the point. My point is that you can be on the left. There's a distinction I want to make between leftism and Marxism. And that when we speak about the pink tide, especially the followers, I'm speaking about people who share at least a bundle of these attitudes. Maybe not in a rigorous, systematic way. But that's what I think of when I think of this new left. It has arisen in the wake of the Cold War, without reference to the Cold War, without reference to Joseph Stalin, or Lenin for that matter, but as a result of local conditions and local realities. Okay? So, if that's a reasonable characterization to make, if that's what the pink tide is, then we can say, okay, what can it do? What are its goals? And what are its capabilities? Well, the goals, I think, are multiple, as is the case of most such groundswells. In the domestic arena, it's, you know, to win power through elections, to rearrange electoral alignments or coalitions, to overturn the status quo, whatever it might have been before, possibly through institutional reform, which might mean disbanding Congress and trying to have a constitutional assembly, in the case of Ecuador, for example, or Bolivia, for that matter, but essentially changing also through these means policy direction. At the hemispheric level, an aspiration, especially of Hugo Chavez, but I think it is shared, is to gain support in neighboring countries, right? To gain support throughout Latin America in a variation of what is known as what I think is the original Bolivarian dream. It's not Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian dream, but Simon Bolivar himself had a dream of Latin American, Spanish American continental unity to offset the power of the United States. It invokes that kind of notion that we are all in this together, and as a consequence, and also as a goal, to reduce U.S. influence and hegemony throughout the hemisphere. Second kind of goal. Third kind of goal at the global level, and this is especially Chavez, but I think others subscribe to it if they're not as active in trying to do it, is to challenge the prevailing international order, to forge alliances with other parts of the developing world and non-aligned nations, and to seek to build what used to be called South-South alignments, or South-South coalitions, that are coalitions among and within countries of the developing world. Quite a bold agenda. So we can begin with a domestic agenda to the hemispheric level, to the global level. So can they do it? Is it possible to bring this about? Well, there are constraints, there are capabilities and constraints. At the domestic level, a lot depends on the strength of the opposition. You know, even if you win the presidency by 51% of the vote, you got 49% against you. And if that includes all of the entrepreneurs and landowners, as well as international interests, then you've got a formidable opposition against you. It is hampered in many cases by the weakness of the state. So that you win control of the state, and then you say, well, I can't do anything with this thing. You know, there's no power left in the state. As one slogan said, you know, a powerless state means a powerless democracy. So you win office, and you discover that you don't have the resources to bring about social change, and economic resources, which range from petroleum in Venezuela to wheat in Argentina, where exports have really been very strong. Economic resources depend on your capacity to export, and that depends on the market, right? It's sort of fluctuating. So you've got numbers of some capabilities and some resources. At the hemispheric level, Hugo Chavez was trying to pull together a package of goods to deliver to countries and presidents to try to bring them into his fold, was consisted largely of Cuban doctors who would work in medical clinics and Venezuelan oil, either the oil itself or earnings from Venezuelan oil. But he would still have to confront persisting U.S. influence. The fact that 7 out of the 18 countries have governments on the right. And also the ambivalent effect of recent economic growth around 5%. It's ambivalent in the sense that you might say, well, a lot of the people who were dissatisfied before should be satisfied now because now there's economic growth. So this would weaken the pink top, or the underpinnings of the pink top. The other thing that's happening is that poverty is not going down. And the windfall profits from some of these exports are not being used very well to deal with social issues. So in a certain sense, there's a backlash from this new prosperity, which is, why aren't you spending the money on me? Or at least to help society. So it cuts both ways. But clearly, one could say that this resumption of growth now at the 5 or 6% level might undermine the social foundations of this pink tide. At the global level, a lot depends on world events. A lot depends on Iraq, for example. A lot depends on the coherence or not of the European Union. A lot depends on China and the sudden emergence of China as a major market. In fact, it was China's purchase of Latin American exports that has accounted for much of this boom and the growth within Latin America. So the things you can't control. A question is whether we're looking at a moment or a trend. Whether, between 2002, 2003, 2004, up to 2008 or 2009, there was this burst of this so-called pink tide that then went out to sea, or whether this represents something longer term. I don't know, but it's the crucial question that we need to ask, and one that I'd be interested in your reflections on. And that would depend a lot on the capabilities and the resources available to pink tide leaders. Now, what does this all have to do with the United States? Why should the United States be involved, except us as political scientists think this is a fascinating phenomenon worthy of several dissertations? You got that, John? I thought about this, and I thought, I could make some things up, but I don't really know if they're really right. I could pronounce them anyway, but ignorance has never prevented me from giving a paper on one thing. But let's start with some assumptions. How the emergence of the pink tide affects some deeply held historic assumptions about relations between the United States and Latin America. And maybe these alone are enough to really demonstrate that there is an impact on the United States. The first cherished assumption, as I like to call it, is the idea in the United States that freely elected leaders will support U.S. policy. This was pretty true during the Cold War, when we spoke of the free world and the communist world. But the presumption we have had as a society and among our political leaders is that if leaders are freely and fairly elected, they will side with the United States. Kissinger was outraged when Chileans elected Allende. And he said, I don't see why we should, recognize Allende just because Chileans are irresponsible. What he should have said was that the opposition was irresponsible because they did not form a right and center coalition against Allende. But in any event, he didn't consult me. The observation I want to make is that there has been this benevolent assumption partly a presumptuous assumption, that freely elected leaders, because they're freely elected and have freedom of choice and represent the will of their people, they will side with the United States. I don't think so. Not if the pink tide, you know, has any meaning for us. It doesn't work anymore. The Western Hemisphere idea is a sort of first cousin to the cherished assumption. The idea that the new world is different from the old, and that the new world is a hemisphere would forge a common front for dealing with the rest of the world. It goes back to the good neighbor policy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It goes even back to the historical interpretations of A.G. Bolton at the University of California, Berkeley, who formed this idea of the Americas as being somehow qualitatively and historically distinct from old Europe and therefore a unified, separate political entity that would join forces together. Well, I don't think so. Not if we have, you know, eight governments on the left and seven on the right and three in the middle, and then you've got the United States and Canada. I don't think that works anymore. I think also we've heard this pretty recently, right? And it's not for me to get embroiled in current political controversy, but I am able to leave town. Is that, you know, one of the rationales for regime change, overthrowing dictators, is that we would bring democracy in their wake. Right? I mean, we've heard this pretty recently, have we not? Well, if these guys are freely and fairly elected, you can't do that. That is, you might want to depose them in some other way, but you can't use that rationale anymore. You can't say, I'm going to overthrow Rafael Correa because he's undemocratic, you know, because he's an authoritarian creature. You can say, you know, I don't like his policy or whatever, but you can't say that he's not democratically elected and doesn't have a democratic claim on office. So that rationale that has been used again and again and again and again through history vanishes. In some ways, getting into power by free and fair elections provides a protective buffer for these guys. For, in fact, all elected political leaders in Latin America and perhaps elsewhere around the world, because it means that that rationale for regime change, for opposing regime change, disappears. There might be other rationales, but not that one. And that has been one that's been very commonly used within the history of U.S. Latin American relations. And lastly, the so-called hegemonic presumption that the United States can, you know, just with one presidential tour, dictate political life in Latin America. That's not the way it works anymore. It might have been the way it worked at various times before, with the exception of Cuba. It worked in some ways during the Cold War. It worked in some ways during the good neighbor policy, etc. But it doesn't work that way anymore. So these deeply held ideas and convictions within the U.S. body politic vanish, or at least they're very sharply challenged by the advent of the pink tide. I think that's a very significant change and shift in the discourse of power as well as in the use of power. Well, then September 11 occurred, and President Bush, shown here, giving probably the finest speech as a speech of the presidency, spoke on September 20th, summoning the United States and the world to a war on terror. And here is shown cradling a policeman's badge and showing the kind of sacrifice that was made at Ground Zero and rallying the American people behind him. Quite effectively, at the time, his approval ratings went up to 92%. That's not a typographical error. I said 92%. And the war on terror was unleashed. And it seems to me, at this juncture, it's fair to speak of rules of the game. I hate to use the language of game because it sounds playful. I don't mean that. But just as a way of speaking, a set of rules about conduct and boundaries that would accompany or be part of the war on terror. As I see it, there were four general categories. One rule was that strong nations could respond to terrorist actions however they wanted, however they felt was necessary, because, in fact, they had faced serious threats. And they, you know, if you're faced with that kind of enemy, this kind of faceless enemy that doesn't have a state, you can't call them on a red line, they wouldn't answer it if you could, that anything goes. Right? They have attacked us. Anything goes. And so you can respond with all available resources, including preventive military action. It's a very sharp change in U.S. military doctrine that we would only respond to an attack first. That we could engage in preventive military action, the idea being we've got to get them before they get us, because it's not like they send a little signal. And other kinds of maneuvers might be engaged in, if you're strong enough to do whatever you can do, do it. Secondly, international treaties and agreements and other things could be safely ignored in the pursuit of this. Third is that allies would be now embraced regardless of their respect for human rights or democracy. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, for example. And spectator nations would keep a relatively low profile and criticize the U.S. with minimum noise and maximum discretion, so to sort of keep out of the fray. I think those were the rules that were kind of set down. You might ask, why would countries abide by them? Well, some countries wanted the same flexibility to defend themselves if necessary. Secondly, some countries said, okay, well, we want the United States to do the heavy lifting against al-Qaeda. We don't want to get involved in that. And thirdly, they might say, well, we don't want to do anything to antagonize either the United States or al-Qaeda, so we'll keep a low profile and accept these kinds of rules. So in this context, U.S.-Latin American relations unfolded for the years after 2001. Now, Bush's stance toward Latin America has evolved over the last 5 years. Since 9/11, a lack of high-level attention, he dropped negotiations on immigration reform, overriding concern for an anti-terrorist campaign. I'm going to move quickly, and politicization of the drug war, even labeling Venezuela as a major transit point, Venezuela, and developing opposition to Chavez and the Pink Tide. Vicente Fox was very unhappy with the proposal to build a wall along the wall, and despite his allegiance to the United States, really spoke out strongly against it, and at least one cartoonist really had a good time with the ambiguities in the Bush policy on migration. So you have this guy, Hugo Chavez. Some people love him. A lot of people hate him. What is it about him? And he is the anointed leader of this pink tide. Well, one is that he uses the language of the street. I clicked wrong here, John. I'm not sure what's going to happen. He uses the language of the street. And by the street, I mean not only the Latin American street, but the Arab street. You listen to the devil speech, you know, that he gave in the United Nations, and just let me read one or two cadences of this. Get a sense of it. Where are my glasses? This doesn't count on my time. But let me just ask yourself, where do you hear this kind of language? He spoke in the United Nations and shocked everybody. Spoke of the hegemonic pretensions of the American Empire placing at risk the very survival of the human species. And he went on at some length about this. He even held up a book by Noam Chomsky, which is a bestseller in Spain. Then he spoke and said, the devil is right at home. The devil of himself is right at home. And the devil came here yesterday. Yesterday, the devil came here, right here. And it smells of sulfur still today. Yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, from this rostrum, the President of the United States, the gentleman to whom I refer as the devil, came here, talking as if he owned the world, truly, the owner of the world. I think we could call a psychiatrist to analyze yesterday's statement made by the President of the United States. As the spokesman of imperialism, he came to share his nostrils, to try to preserve the current pattern of domination, exploitation, and pillage of the people of the world. Oh, Macron, where does this guy get off saying this at the UN? Who did he sound like? Leaders of Iran. Leaders in the Middle East. His friends of petro-producing countries. He was using that Arab street language. Also, you know, one would have to say, the Latin American street, of course. He shocked everybody. He torpedoed his own country's chances for getting a seat on the Security Council of the United Nations. But he sure did use language that reverberated and makes people either angry or laugh or both. But it's a different discourse that he's willing to use. He sits atop a lot of petroleum. He puts money where his mouth is. He breaks all the rules of the game, like speaking at the UN and criticizing a head of government and state by name. He plays off the resentment of Bush and U.S. power. He openly challenges the Washington consensus and the free trade area of the Americas movement. He plays for very high stakes, going for a Security Council seat and the leadership of the non-aligned movement. And he does seek rearrangement of the prevailing world order. So I say, this guy, you know, is either crazy or dangerous or both. And here he is, introducing a book by Chomsky just before he came to the passage of the devil speech that I just read. Now, what is the Bush administration going to do about this? They try to inoculate against the big talk. They try to circumvent his influence by a string of bilateral free trade agreements with other more friendly countries. They bypass the FTAA and go for bilaterals. They cultivate and try to co-opt Lula, who's visiting in Washington today or tomorrow or soon. And then the president undertook a tour a couple of weeks ago to carefully selected countries where he announced a rhetoric of social concern. The only real deliverable was ethanol, an ethanol agreement with Brazil. But in fact, symbolic meaning, it's ethanol instead of petroleum. You know, we're not going to need you, Hugo, very long, because we're going to replace it with ethanol on the basis of an agreement with Brazil, which will bring Lula into our camp, which will bring Brazil into our camp, which will give Brazil the sense that it can become the co-leader of the Western Hemisphere and a great power. And at this same time, Hugo Chavez undertook a counter tour in other countries of his friends to sort of offset the influence of the United States. Here's Bush and Lula at an earlier meeting. You can see it's sort of the, you know, the body chemistry is that they're getting along fine. Lula's doing both, right? He's being in the pink friend of Chavez and friend of Bush. So, implications for the future in a hurry, and then I promise, John, I'll finish. Let me ask about visions for Latin America. What would, say, George Bush want, and many American political leaders, and perhaps many of us? We'd want a democratic Latin America with a tilt to the right or the center right. We'd want a prosperous Latin America, but with a commitment to free market policies. We'd want a unified Latin America under U.S. leadership. He would, anyway. A peaceful Latin America in view of the unanimity that you peace would follow, and deferential to the U.S. in global matters. Certainly that's what Bush would want. I suspect even many democratic, you know, political leaders would like that also. What's the pink tie suggest? That vision is no longer possible, at least not at this moment. That you get a broad range of ideological ideas, that prosperity comes from mixed economies as well as from free market economies. In fact, the highest growth rates have been registered not in FTA countries that have free trade with the U.S. recently, but in pink tide countries, Argentina, Uruguay, and Venezuela. Diversity and ideology rather than unity that reflects also anti-U.S. attitudes, a rejection of U.S. leadership and rules of the game, a search for allies and friends outside the Western Hemisphere on the ground that there's no reason that we have to put up with the United States because we're in the same hemisphere. And finally, let me just say the pink tide is not Hugo Chavez. It's those people in various countries who vote for or against this pink tide. So, final questions here. Is the conflict necessary? Would it be possible to say, one is view is pink tide and Chavez are really a threat to American interests and therefore got to do something. Maybe Bush is doing the wrong thing, but we got to do something. Another view would say, we don't have to fight with these guys. You know, they're not our enemies. You know, there's a way to work with them, and there must be a way to work with them. And let me come back to a final point, and I'll end right here. Whoops, I'll end right here. From the standpoint of the United States, if we want a reasonable and prosperous and democratic Latin America, aren't we lucky that these disenchanted people are expressing their disenchantment by going to the ballot box and voting for whoever they're voting for, rather than engaging in violence and revolutionary terrorist action? Aren't we lucky? Aren't we in the United States lucky that that's their choice, that they're using the ballot box to do this? They're electing people maybe we don't favor. They're electing people whose policies might be a little wrong-headed. They're electing people who might not be as well-informed as we are, but they're doing it through the ballot box. Can you ask for anything more? That's the end of the talk.